imprisoned with the grey direwolf of House Stark, while Bran wore grey breeches and white doublet, his sleeves and collar trim with vair. Over his heart was the wolf's head brooch of silver and polished jet. He would sooner have had Summer than a silver wolf on his breast, but Sir Roderick had been unyielding. The low stone steps balked Dancer only for a moment. When Bran urged her on, she took them easily. Beyond the wide oaken iron doors, 8 long rows of trestle tables filled Winterfell's great hall, 4 on each side of the center aisle. Men crowded shoulder to shoulder on the benches. "Stark!" they called as Bran trotted past, rising to their feet. "Winterfell! Winterfell!" He was old enough to know that it was not truly him they shouted for. It was the harvest they cheered. It was Rob and his victories. It was his Lord Father and his grandfather and all the Starks going back 8,000 years. Still, it made him swell with pride. For so long as it took him to ride the length of that hall, he forgot that he was broken. Yet when he reached the dais, with every eye upon him, Osha and Hodor undid his straps and buckles, lifted him off Dancer's back, and carried him to the high seat of his father's. Sir Roderick was seated to Bran's left, his daughter Beth beside him. Rickon was to his right, his mop of shaggy auburn hair grown so long that it brushed his ermine mantle. He had refused to let anyone cut it since their mother had gone. The last girl to try had been bitten for her efforts. "I wanted to ride too," he said as Hodor led Dancer away. "I ride better than you." "You don't, so hush up," he told his brother. Sir Roderick bellowed for quiet. Bran raised his voice. He bid them welcome, in the name of his brother, the king in the north, and asked them to thank the gods, old and new, for Rob's victories and the bounty of the harvest. "May there be 100 more," he finished, raising his father's silver goblet. 100 more! Pewter tankards, clay cups, and iron-banded drinking horns clashed together. Bran's wine was sweetened with honey and fragrant with cinnamon and cloves, but stronger than he was used to. He could feel its hot, snaky fingers wriggling through his chest as he swallowed. By the time he set down the goblet, his head was swimming. "You did well, Bran," Sir Roderick told him. "Lord Eddard would have been most proud." Down the table, Maester Lewin nodded his agreement as the servers began to carry in the food. Such food Bran had never seen, course after course after course, so much that he could not manage more than a bite or two of each dish. There were great joints of oryx roasted with leeks, venison pies chunky with carrots, bacon and mushrooms, mutton chops sauced in honey and cloves, savoury duck, peppered boar, goose, skewers of pigeon and capon, beef and barley stew, cold fruit soup. Lord Wyman had brought 20 casks of fish from White Harbour, packed in salt and seaweed, whitefish and winkles, crabs and mussels, clams, heron, cod, salmon, lobster and lampreys. There was black bread and honey cakes and oaten biscuits. There were turnips and peas and beets, beans and squash and huge red onions. There were baked apples and berry tarts and pears poached in strong wine. Wheels of white cheese were set at every table, above and below the salt, and flagons of hot spice wine and chilled autumn ale were passed up and down the tables. Lord Wyman's musicians played bravely and well, but harp and fiddle and horn were soon drowned beneath a tide of talk and laughter, the clash of cup and plate, and the snarling of hounds fighting for table scraps. The singer sang good songs, Iron Lancers, and The Burning of the Ships, and The Bear and the Maiden Fair, but only Hodor seemed to be listening. He stood beside the piper, hopping from one foot to the other. The noise swelled to a steady rumbling roar, a great heady stew of sound. Sir Roderick talked with Maester Lewin above Beth's curly head while Rickon screamed happily at the Walders. Bran had not wanted the phrase at the high table, but the maester reminded him that they would soon begin. Rob was to marry one of their aunts, and Arya one of their uncles. "She never will," Bran said. "Not Arya." But Maester Lewin was unyielding, so there they were beside Rickon. The serving men brought every dish to Bran first that he might take the lord's portion if he chose. By the time they reached the ducks, he could eat no more. After that, he nodded approval at each course in turn and waved it away. If the dish smelt especially choice, he would send it to one of the lords on the dais, a gesture of friendship and favour that Maester Lewin told him he must make. He sent some salmon down to poor, sad Lady Hornwood, the boar to the boisterous Umbers, a dish of goose and berries to Clay Serwin, and a huge lobster to Joseph, the master of horse, who was neither lord nor guest, but had seen to dancers' training and made it possible for Bran to ride. He sent sweets to Hodor and old Nan as well, for no reason, but he loved them. Sir Roderick reminded him to send something to his foster brothers, so he sent Little Walder some boiled beets and Big Walder the buttered turnips. On the benches below, Winterfell men mixed with small folk from the winter town, friends from the nearer Holdfast, and the escorts of their lordly guests. Some faces Bran had never seen before, others he knew as well as his own, yet they all seemed equally foreign to him. He watched them as from a distance, as if he still sat in the window of his bedchamber, looking down on the yard below, seeing everything, yet a part of nothing. Usher moved among the tables, pouring ale. One of Leobald Tallheart's men slid a hand up under her skirts, and she broke the flagon over his head to roars of laughter. Yet Mickon had his hand down some woman's bodice, and she seemed not to mind. Bran watched Fardon make his red bitch beg for bones and smiled at old Nan plucking at the crust of a hot pie with wrinkled fingers. On the dais, Lord Wyman attacked a steaming plate of lampreys as if they were an enemy host. He was so fat that Sir Roderick had commanded that a special wide chair be built for him to sit in. But he laughed loud and often, and Bran thought he liked him. Poor one Lady Hornwood sat beside him, her face a stony mask, as she picked listlessly at her food. At the opposite end of the high table, Hothan and Mors were playing a drinking game, slamming their horns together as hard as knights meeting in joust. "It is too hot here, and too noisy, and they're all getting drunk." Bran itched under his grey and white woolens, and suddenly he wished he were anywhere but here. It is cool in the Godswood now. Steam is rising off the hot pools, and the red leaves of the weirwood are rustling. The smells are richer than here, and before long the moon will rise, and my brother will sing to it.
"Bran," Sir Roderick said, "you do not eat."
The waking dream had been so vivid. For a moment, Bran had not known where he was. "I'll have more later," he said. "My belly's full to bursting." The old knight's white moustache was pink with wine.
"You have done well, Bran. Here and at the audiences. You will be an especially fine lord one day, I think."
"I want to be a knight." Bran took another sip of the spiced honey wine from his father's goblet, grateful for something to clutch. The lifelike head of a snarling direwolf was raised on the side of the cup. He felt the silver muzzle pressing against his palm, and remembered the last time he had seen his lord father drink from this goblet. It had been the night of the welcoming feast, when King Robert had brought his court to Winterfell. Summer still reigned then. His parents had shared the dais with Robert and his queen, with her brothers beside her. Uncle Benjen had been there too, all in black. Bran and his brothers and sisters sat with the king's children, Joffrey and Tommen, and Princess Myrcella, who spent the whole meal gazing at Rob with adoring eyes. Arya made faces across the table when no one was looking. Sansa listened raptly, while the king's high harper sang songs of chivalry, and Rickon kept asking why Jon wasn't with them. "Because he's a bastard," Bran finally had to whisper to him. "And now they are all gone." It was as if some cruel god had reached down with a great hand and swept them all away. Girls to captivity, Jon to the wall, Rob and mother to war, King Robert and father to their graves, and perhaps Uncle Benjen as well. Even down on the benches there were new men at the tables. Jorah was dead, and Fat Tom, and Porther, Alan, Desmond, Hollan, who had been master of horse, Harwin, his son, all those who had gone south with his father, even Septa Mordane and Vaen Poole. The rest had ridden to war with Rob, and might soon be dead as well, for all Bran knew. He liked Hayhead and Poxy Tim and Skittrick and the other new men well enough, but he missed his old friends. He looked up and down the benches at all the faces, happy and sad, and wondered who would be missing next year and the year after. He might have cried then, but he couldn't. He was the Stark in Winterfell, his father's son and his brother's heir, and almost a man grown. At the foot of the hall, the doors opened, and a gust of cold air made the torches flame brighter for an instant. Alebelly led two new guests into the feast.
"The Lady Mira of House Reed,"
the rotund guardsman bellowed over the clamber,
"with her brother, Jojen, and Greywater Watch."
Men looked up from their cups and trenchers to eye the newcomers. Bran heard Little Walder mutter, "Frog eaters," to Big Walder beside him. Sir Roderick climbed to his feet.
"Be welcome, friends, and share this harvest with us."
Serving men hurried to lengthen the tables on the dais, fetching trestles and chairs.
"Who are they?"
Rickon asked.
"Mud men," answered Little Walder disdainfully. "They're thieves and cravens, and they have green teeth from eating frogs."
Maester Lewin crouched beside Bran's seat to whisper counsel in his ear.
"You must greet these ones warmly. I had not thought to see them here, but you know who they are."
Bran nodded. "Crannog men from the Neck."
"Howland Reed was a great friend to your father," Sir Roderick told him. "These two are his, it would seem."
As the newcomers walked the length of the hall, Bran saw that one was indeed a girl, though he would never have known it from her dress. She wore lambskin breeches soft with long use, and a sleeveless jerkin armoured in bronze scales. Though near Rob's age, she was slim as a boy, with long brown hair knotted behind her head, and only the barest suggestion of breasts. A woven net hung from one slim hip, a long bronze knife from the other. Under her arm she carried an old iron great helm spotted with rust. A frog spear and round leathern shield was strapped to her back. Her brother was several years younger and bore no weapons. All his garb was green, even to the leather of his boots, and when he came closer, Bran saw that his eyes were the colour of moths, though his teeth looked as white as anyone else's. Both Reeds were slight of build, slender as swords and scarcely taller than Bran himself. They went to one knee before the dais.
"My lords of Stark," the girl said, "the years have passed in their hundreds and their thousands since my folk first swore their fealty to the king in the north. My lord father has sent us here to say the words again for all our people."
"She is looking at me," Bran realized. He had to make some answer. "My brother Rob is fighting in the south," he said, "but you can say your words to me if you like."
"To Winterfell we pledge the faith of Greywater," they said together. "Hearth and heart and harvest we yield up to you, my lord. Our swords and spears and arrows are yours to command. Grant mercy to our weak, help to our helpless, and justice to all, and we shall never fail you." "I swear it by earth and water," said the boy in green. "I swear it by bronze and iron," his sister said. "We swear it by ice and fire," they finished together. Bran groped for words. Was he supposed to swear something back to them? Their oath was not one he had been taught. "May your winters be short and your summers bountiful," he said. That was usually a good thing to say. "Rise, I'm Brandon Stark." The girl, Mira, got to her feet and helped her brother up. The boy stared at Bran all the while. "We bring you gifts of fish and frog and fowl," he said.
"I thank you." Bran wondered if he would have to eat a frog to be polite. "I offer you the meat and mead of Winterfell." He tried to recall all he had been taught of the Crannog men, who dwelt among the bugs of the neck and seldom left their wetlands. They were a poor folk, fishers and frog hunters, who lived in houses of thatch and woven reed on floating islands hidden in the deeps of the swamp. It was said that they were a cowardly people who fought with poison weapons and preferred to hide from their foes rather than face them in open battle. And yet Halen Reed had been one of Father's staunchest companions during the war for King Robert's crown, before Bran was born. The boy, Jojen, looked about the hall curiously as he took his seat.
"Where are the direwolves?"
"In the guard's wood," Rickon answered. "Shaggy was bad."
"My brother would like to see them," the girl said.
Little Alder spoke up loudly.
"Ed, best watch they don't see him, or they'll take a bite out of him."
"They won't bite if I'm here." Bran was pleased that they wanted to see the wolves. "Summer won't anyway, and he'll keep Shaggy Dog away." He was curious about these mudmen. He could not recall ever seeing one before. His father had sent letters to the Lord of Greywater over the years, but none of the Crannog men had ever called at Winterfell. He would have liked to talk to them more, but the great hall was so noisy that it was hard to hear anyone who wasn't right beside you. Sir Roderick was right beside Bran.
"Do they truly eat frogs?" he asked the old knight.
"Aye," Sir Roderick said. "Frogs and fish and lizard lions and all manner of birds."
"Maybe they don't have sheep and cattle," Bran thought.
He commanded the serving men to bring them mutton chops and a slice off the oryx and fill their trenches with beef and barley stew. They seemed to like that well enough. The girl caught him staring at her and smiled. Bran blushed and looked away. Much later, after all the sweets had been served and washed down with gallons of summer wine, the food was cleared and the tables shoved back against the walls to make room for the dancing. The music grew wilder, the drummers joined in, and Hutha Umber brought forth a huge curved war horn banded in silver. When the singer reached the part in The Night That Ended, where the Night's Watch rode forth to meet the others in the battle for the dawn, he blew a blast that set all the dogs to barking. Two Glover men began a spinning skirl on bladder and woodharp. Mors Umber was the first on his feet. He seized a passing servant girl by the arm, knocking the flagon of wine out of her hands to shatter on the floor. Amidst the rushes and bones and bits of bread that littered the stone, he whirled her and spun her and tossed her in the air. The girl squealed with laughter and turned red as her skirt swirled and lifted. Others soon joined in. Hodor began to dance all by himself, while Lord Wyman asked little Beth Cassell to partner him. For all his size, he moved gracefully. When he tired, Clay Serwyn danced with a child in his stead. Sir Roderick approached Lady Hornwood, but she made her excuses and took her leave. Bran watched long enough to be polite, and then had Hodor summoned. He was hot and tired, flushed from the wine, and the dancing made him sad. It was something else he could never do. "I want to go."
"Hodor!"
Hodor shouted back, kneeling. Maester Lewin and Hayhead lifted him into his basket. The folk of Winterfell had seen this sight half 100 times, but doubtless it looked queer to the guests,
some of whom were more curious than polite. Bran felt the stares. They went out the rear rather than walk the length of the hall, Bran ducking his head as they passed through the Lord's door. In the dim-lit gallery outside the great hall, they came upon Joseph, the master of horse, engaged in a different sort of riding. He had some woman, Bran did not know, shoved up against the wall, her skirts around her waist. She was giggling until Hodor stopped to watch. Then she screamed. "Leave them be, Hodor," Bran had to tell him. "Take me to my bedchamber." Hodor carried him up the winding steps to his tower and knelt beside one of the iron bars that Mickon had driven into the wall. Bran used the bars to move himself to the bed, and Hodor pulled off his boots and breeches. "You can go back to the feast now, but don't go bothering Joseph and that woman," Bran said.
"Hodor,"
Hodor replied, bobbing his head. When he blew out his bedside candle, darkness covered him like a soft, familiar blanket, the faint sound of music drifting through his shuttered window. Something his father had told him once, when he was little, came back to him suddenly. He had asked Lord Eddard if the King's Guard were truly the finest knights in the Seven Kingdoms. "No longer," he answered, "but once they were a marvel, a shining lesson to the world." "Was there one who was best of all?" "The finest knight I ever saw was Sir Arthur Dane, who fought with a blade called Dawn, forged from the heart of a fallen star. They called him the Sword of the Morning, and he would have killed me but for Howland Reed." Father had gotten sad then, and he would say no more. Bran wished he had asked him what he meant. He went to sleep with his head full of knights in gleaming armor, fighting with swords that shone like star fire. But when the dream came, he was in the Godswood again. The smells from the kitchen and the great hall were so strong that it was almost as if he had never left the feast. He prowled beneath the trees, his brother close behind him. This night was wildly alive, full of the howling of the man-pack at their play. The sounds made him restless. He wanted to run, to hunt, he wanted to... The rattle of iron made his ears prick up. His brother heard it too. They raced through the undergrowth toward the sound. Bounding across the still water at the foot of the old white one, he caught the scent of a stranger, the man smell, well mixed with leather and earth and iron. The intruders had pushed a few yards into the wood when he came upon them, a female and a young male, with no taint of fear to them, even when he showed them the white of his teeth. His brother growled low in his throat, yet still they did not run.
"Here they come," the female said.
"Mira," some part of him whispered, some wisp of the sleeping boy lost in the wolf dream.
"Did you know they would be so big?" "They will be bigger still before they're grown," the young male said, watching them with eyes large, green, and unafraid. "The black one is full of fear and rage, but the grey is strong, stronger than he knows. Can you feel him, sister?"
"No," she said, moving a hand to the hilt of the long brown knife she wore.
"Go careful, Jojen. He won't hurt me. This is not the day I die."
The male walked toward them, unafraid, and reached out for his muzzle, a touch as light as a summer breeze. Yet at the brush of those fingers, the wood dissolved, and the very ground turned to smoke beneath his feet and swirled away laughing. And then he was spinning and falling, falling, falling. Jamie. 2 days' ride to either side of the King's Road, they passed through a wide swathe of destruction, miles of blackened fields and orchards, where the trunks of dead trees jutted into the air like archers' stakes. The bridges were burnt as well, and the streams swollen by autumn rains, so they had to range along the banks in search of fords. The knights were alive with howling of wolves, but they saw no people. At Maidenpool, Lord Mouton's red salmon still flew above the castle on its hill, but the town walls were deserted, the gates smashed, half the homes and shops burned or plundered. They saw nothing living, but a few feral dogs that went slinking away at the sound of their approach. The pool from which the town took its name, where legend said that Florian the Fool had first glimpsed Jonquil bathing with her sisters, was so choked with rotting corpses that the water had turned into a murky grey-green soup. Jamie took one look and burst into song. Six maids there were in a spring-fed pool.
What are you doing?
Brian demanded.
Singing. Six maids in a pool, I'm sure you've heard it. And shy little maids they were, too, rather like you, though somewhat prettier, I'll warrant.
Be quiet, the wench said, with a look that suggested she would love to leave him floating in the pool among the corpses.
Please, Jamie, pleaded Cousin Cleos. Lord Mouton is sworn to Riverrun. We don't want to draw him out of his castle, and there may be other enemies hiding in the rubble.
Hers or ours? They're not the same, cuz. I have a yen to see if the wench can use that sword she wears.
If you won't be quiet, you'll leave me no choice but to gag you, Kingslayer.
Unchain my hands, and I'll play mute all the way to King's Landing. Now what could be fairer than that, wench?
Brian! My name is Brian!
Three crows went flapping into the air, startled at the sound.
Care for a bath, Brian?
He laughed. You're a maiden, and there's the pool. I'll wash your back. He used to scrub Cersei's back when they were children together at Casterly Rock. The wench turned her horse's head and trotted away. Jamie and Sir Cleos followed her out of the ashes of Maidenpool. A half mile on, green began to creep back into the world once more. Jamie was glad. The burned lands reminded him too much of Aerys.
She's taking the Duskendale Road, Sir Cleos muttered. It would be safer to follow the coast.
Safer, but slower. I'm for Duskendale, cuz, if truth be told, I'm bored with your company. You may be half Lannister, but you're a far cry from my sister. He could never bear to be long apart from his twin. Even as children, they would creep into each other's beds and sleep with their arms entwined, even in the womb. Long before his sister's flowering, or the advent of his own manhood, they had seen mares and stallions in the fields, and dogs and bitches in the kennels, and played at doing the same. Once their mother's maid had caught them at it. He did not recall just what they had been doing, but whatever it was had horrified Lady Joanna. She'd sent the maid away, moved Jamie's bedchamber to the other side of Casterly Rock, set a guard outside Cersei's, and told them that they must never do that again, or she would have no choice but to tell their lord father. They need not have feared, though. It was not long after that she died birthing Tyrion. Jamie barely remembered what his mother had looked like. Perhaps Stannis Baratheon and the Starks had done him a kindness. They had spread their tale of incest all over the Seven Kingdoms, so there was nothing left to hide.
Why shouldn't I marry Cersei openly and share her bed every night? The dragons always married their sisters.
Septons, lords, and small folk had turned a blind eye to the Targaryens for hundreds of years. Let them do the same for House Lannister. It would play havoc with Joffrey's claim to the crown, to be sure, but in the end it had been swords that had won the Iron Throne for Robert, and swords could keep Joffrey there as well, regardless of whose seed he was.
We could marry him to Myrcella once we sent Sansa Stark back to her mother. That would show the realm that the Lannisters are above their laws, like gods and Targaryens.
Jaime had decided that he would return Sansa, and the younger girl as well, if she could be found. It was not like to win him back his lost honour, but the notion of keeping faith when they all expected betrayal amused him more than he could say. They were riding past a trampled wheat field and a low stone wall when Jamie heard a soft thrum from behind, as if a dozen birds had taken flight at once. "Down!" he shouted, throwing himself against the neck of his horse. The gelding screamed and reared as an arrow took him in the rump. Other shafts went hissing past. Jamie saw Sir Cleus lurch from the saddle, twisting as his foot caught in the stirrup. His palfrey bolted, and Frey was dragged past, shouting, head bouncing against the ground. Jamie's gelding lumbered off ponderously, blowing and snorting in pain. He craned around to look for Brienne. She was still a horse, an arrow lodged in her back and another in her leg, but she seemed not to feel them. He saw her pull her sword and wheel in a circle, searching for the bowman. "Behind the wall!" Jamie called, fighting to turn his half-blind mount back toward the fight. The reins were tangled in his damned chains, and the air was full of arrows again. "At them!" he shouted, kicking to show her how it was done. The old sorry horse found a burst of speed from somewhere. Suddenly they were racing across the wheat field, throwing up clouds of chaff. Jamie had just enough time to think. "The wench had better follow before they realize they're being charged by an unarmed man in chains." Then he heard her coming hard behind. "Evenfall!" she shouted as her plough horse thundered by. She brandished her longsword. "Tarth! Tarth!" A few last arrows sped harmlessly past. Then the bowman broke and ran. The way unsupported bowmen always broke and ran before the charge of knights. Brienne reined up at the wall. By the time Jamie reached her, they had all melted into the wood 20 yards away. "Lost your tears for battle?" "They were running." "That's the best time to kill them." She sheathed her sword. "Why did you charge?" "Bowmen are fearless so long as they can hide behind walls and shoot at you from afar, but if you come at them, they run. They know what will happen when you reach them. You have an arrow in your back, you know, and another in your leg. You're to let me tend them." "You? Who else?" "The last I saw of Cousin Cleos, his palfrey was using his head to plough a furrow. I suppose we ought to find him. He is a Lannister of sorts." They found Cleos still tangled in his stirrup. He had an arrow through his right arm and a second in his chest, but it was the ground that had done for him. The top of his head was matted with blood and mushy to the touch, pieces of broken bone moving under the skin beneath the pressure of Jamie's hand. Brienne knelt and held his hand. "He's still warm. He'll cool soon enough. I want his horse and his clothes. I'm weary of rags and fleas." "He was your cousin." The wench was shocked. "Was," Jamie agreed. "Have no fear. I'm amply provisioned in cousins. I'll have his sword as well. You need someone to share the watches." "You can stand a watch without weapons?" She rose. "Chained to a tree? Perhaps I could, or perhaps I could make my own bargain with the next lot of outlaws, and let them slit that thick neck of yours, wench." "I will not arm you, and my name is Brienne, I know. I'll swear an oath not to harm you, if that will ease your girlish fears." "Your oaths are worthless. You swore an oath to Ares." "You haven't cooked anyone in their armour, so far as I know, and we both want me safe and whole in King's Landing, don't we?" He squatted beside Cleos and began to undo his sword belt. "Step away from him now. Stop that." Jamie was tired, tired of her suspicions, tired of her insults, tired of her crooked teeth and her broad, spotty face and that limp, thin hair of hers. Ignoring her protests, he grasped the hilt of his cousin's longsword with both hands, held the corpse down with his foot, and pulled. As the blade slid from the scabbard, he was already pivoting, bringing the sword around and up in a swift, deadly arc. Steel met steel with a ringing, bone-jarring clang. Somehow Brienne had gotten her own blade out in time. Jamie laughed. "Very good, wench."
"Give me the sword, Kingslayer."
"Oh, I will." He sprang to his feet and drove at her, the longsword alive in his hands. Brienne jumped back, parrying, but he followed, pressing the attack. No sooner did she turn one cut than the next was upon her. The swords kissed and sprang apart and kissed again. Jamie's blood was singing. This was what he was meant for. He never felt so alive as when he was fighting, with death balanced on every stroke. And with my wrist chained together, the wench may even give me a contest for a time. His chains forced him to use a two-handed grip, though, of course, the weight and reach were far less than if the blade had been a true two-handed greatsword, but what did it matter? His cousin's sword was long enough to write an end to this Brienne of Tarth. High, low, overhand, he rained down steel upon her, left, right, backslash, swinging so hard the sparks flew when the swords came together, upswing, sideslash, overhand, always attacking, moving into her, step and slide, strike and step and strike, hacking and slashing, faster, 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 until, breathless, he stepped back and let the point of the sword fall to the ground, giving her a moment of respite. "Not half bad," he acknowledged. "For a wench?" She took a slow, deep breath, her eyes watching him warily. "I would not hurt you, Kingslayer." "As if you could." He whirled the blade back above his head and flew at her again, chains rattling. Jamie could not have said how long he pressed the attack. It might have been minutes or it might have been hours. Time slept when swords woke. He drove her away from his cousin's corpse, drove her across the road, drove her into the trees. She stumbled once on a route she never saw, and for a moment he thought she was done. But she went to one knee instead of falling, and never lost a beat. Her sword leapt up to block a downcut that would have opened her from shoulder to groin, and then she cut at him again and again, fighting her way back to her feet, stroke by stroke. The dance went on. He pinned her against an oak, cursed as she slipped away, followed her through a shallow brook, half choked with fallen leaves. Steel rang, steel sang, steel screamed and sparked and scraped. And the woman started grunting like a sow at every crash. Yet somehow he could not reach her. It was as if she had an iron cage around her that stopped every blow. "Not bad at all," he said when he paused for a second to catch his breath, circling to her right.
"For a wench?"
"For a squire, say? A green one?" He laughed, a ragged, breathless laugh. "Come on. Come on, my sweetling. The music's still playing. Might I have this dance, my lady?" Grunting, she came at him, blade whirling, and suddenly it was Jamie struggling to keep steel from skin. One of her slashes raked across his brow, and blood ran down into his right eye. "The others take her, and river run as well." His skills had gone to rust and rot in that bloody dungeon, and the chains were no great help either. His eye closed, his shoulders were going numb from the jarring they'd taken, and his wrists ached from the weight of chains, manacles, and sword. His long sword grew heavier with every blow, and Jamie knew he was not swinging it as quickly as he'd done earlier, nor raising it as high. "She is stronger than I am." The realization chilled him. Robert had been stronger than him, to be sure. The White Bull, Gerald Hightower as well, in his heyday, and Sir Arthur Dane. Amongst the living, great John Umber was stronger. Strongbore of Crakehall, most likely. Both Cleganes, for a certainty. The mountain's strength was like nothing human. It did not matter. With speed and skill, Jamie could beat them all. But this was a woman. A huge cow of a woman, to be sure, but even so, by rights, she should be the one wearing down. Instead, she forced him back into the brook again, shouting, "Yield! Throw down the sword!" A slick stone turned under Jamie's foot. As he felt himself falling, he twisted the mischance into a diving lunge. His point scraped past her parry and bit into her upper thigh. A red flower blossomed, and Jamie had an instant to savour the sight of her blood before his knee slammed into a rock. The pain was blinding. Brienne splashed into him and kicked away his sword. "Yield!" Jamie drove his shoulder into her legs, bringing her down on top of him. They rolled, kicking and punching, until finally she was sitting astride him. He managed to jerk her dagger from its sheath. But before he could plunge it into her belly, she caught his wrist and slammed his hands back on a rock so hard he thought she'd wrenched an arm from its socket. Her other hand spread across his face. "Yield!" She shoved his head down, held it under, pulled it up. "Yield!" Jamie spit water into her face. A shove, a splash, and he was under again, kicking uselessly, fighting to breathe. Up again. Yield, or I'll drown you.
And break your oath? He snarled. Like me?
She let him go, and he went down with a splash. And the woods rang with coarse laughter. Brian lurched to her feet. She was all mud and blood below the waist, her clothing askew, her face red.
She looks as if they caught us fucking instead of fighting.
Jamie crawled over the rocks to shallow water, wiping the blood from his eye with his chained hands. Armed men lined both sides of the brook. Small wonder we were making enough noise to wake a dragon.
Well met, friends, he called to them amiably. My pardons if I disturbed you. You caught me chastising my wife.
Seemed to me she was doing the chastising.
The man who spoke was thick and powerful, and the nasal bar of his iron half-helm did not wholly conceal his lack of a nose. These were not the outlaws who had killed Sir Cleos, Jamie realized suddenly. The scum of the earth surrounded them, swarthy Dornishmen and blond Lyseni, Dothraki with bells in their braids, hairy Ebonese, coal-black summer islanders in feathered cloaks. He knew them, the brave companions. Brian found her voice.
I have 100 stags.
A cadaverous man in a tattered leather cloak said,
We'll take that first tart, m'lady. And then we'll have your cunt, said the noseless man. It can't be as ugly as the rest of you.
Turn her over and rape her ass, roared,
urged a Dornish spearman with a red silk scarf wound about his helm.
That way you won't need to look at her.
And rob her of the pleasure of looking at me,
Noseless said, and the others laughed. Ugly and stubborn though she might be, the wench deserved better than to be gang-raped by such refuse as these. Who commands here? Jamie demanded loudly.
I have that honour, Sir Jamie.
The cadaver's eyes were rimmed in red, his hair thin and dry. Dark blue veins could be seen through the pallid skin of his hands and face.
Urswick I am, called Urswick the Faithful.
You know who I am? The sellsword inclined his head.
It takes more than a beard and a shaved head to deceive the brave companions.
The bloody mummers, you mean? Jamie had no more use for these than he did for Gregor Clegane or Amory Lorch. Dogs, his father called them all, and he used them like dogs to hound his prey and put fear in their hearts. If you know me, Urswick, you know you'll have your reward. A Lannister always pays his debts. As for the wench, she's high-born and worth a good ransom. The other cocked his head.
Is it so? How fortunate!
There was something sly about the way Urswick was smiling that Jamie did not like. You heard me. Where's the goat?
A few hours distant. He will be pleased to see you, I've no doubt. But I would not call him a goat to his face. Lord Vargo grows prickly about his dignity.
Since when has that slobbering savage had dignity? I'll be sure and remember that when I see him. Lord of what, pray?
Harren Hal, it has been promised.
Harren Hal? Has my father taken leave of his senses? Jamie raised his hands. I'll have these chains off. Urswick's chuckle was papery dry.
Something is very wrong here.
Jamie gave no sign of his discomfiture, but only smiled.
Did I say something amusing?
Noseless grinned.
You're the funniest thing I've seen since Barter chewed that scepter's tits off.
You and your father lost too many battles, offered the Dornishman. We had to trade our lion pelts for wolf skins.
Urswick spread his hands.
What Kimian means to say is that the brave companions are no longer in the hire of House Lannister. We now serve Lord Bolton and the King in the North.
Jamie gave him a cold, contemptuous smile. And men say I have shit for honour. Urswick was unhappy with that comment. At his signal, two of the mummers grasped Jamie by the arms, and Rogue drove a mailed fist into his stomach. As he doubled over, grunting, he heard the wench protesting.
"Stop! He's not to be armed! Lady Catelyn sent us an exchange of captives! He's under my protection!"
Rogue hit him again, driving the air from his lungs. Brian dove for her sword beneath the waters of the brook, but the mummers were on her before she could lay hands on it. Strong as she was, it took four of them to beat her into submission. By the end, the wench's face was as swollen and bloody as Jamie's must have been, and they had knocked out two of her teeth. It did nothing to improve her appearance. Stumbling and bleeding, the two captives were dragged back through the woods to the horses, Brian limping from the thigh wound he'd given her in the brook. Jamie felt sorry for her. She would lose her maidenhood tonight, he had no doubt. That noseless bastard would have her for a certainty, and some of the others would likely take a turn. The Dornishmen bound them back to back atop Brian's plough horse, while the other mummers were stripping Cleos Frey to his skin to divvy up his possessions. Rorg won the blood-stained surcoat with its proud Lannister and Frey quarterings. The arrows had punched holes through lions and towers alike. "I hope you're pleased, wench," Jamie whispered at Brian. He coughed and spat out a mouthful of blood. "If you'd armed me, we'd never have been taken." She made no answer. "There's a pig, stubborn bitch," he thought. "But brave, yes. He could not take that from her. When we make camp for the night, you'll be raped, and more than once," he warned her. "You'd be wise not to resist. If you fight them, you'll lose more than a few teeth." He felt Brian's back stiffen against his. "Is that what you would do, if you were a woman?"
"If I were a woman, I'd be Cersei."
"If I were a woman, I'd make them kill me. But I'm not." Jamie kicked their horse into a trot. "Urswick, a word." The cadaverous sellsword in the ragged leather cloak reined up a moment and fell in beside him.
"What will you have of me, sir? And mind your tongue, or I'll chastise you again."
"Gold," said Jamie. "You do like gold."
Urswick studied him through reddened eyes.
"It has its uses, I do confess."
Jamie gave Urswick a knowing smile. "All the gold in Casterly Rock. Why, let the goat enjoy it. Why not take us to King's Landing and collect my ransom for yourself? Hers as well, if you like. Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle, a maiden told me once." The wench squirmed at that, but said nothing.
"Do you take me for a turn, cloak?"
"Certainly. What else?"
For half a heartbeat, Urswick considered the proposition.
"King's Landing is a long way, and your father is there. Lord Tywin may resent us for selling Harrenhal to Lord Bolton."
"He's cleverer than he looks."
Jamie had been looking forward to hanging the wretch while his pockets bulged with gold.
"Leave me to deal with my father. I'll get your royal pardon for any crimes you have committed. I'll get your knighthood."
"Sir Urswick,"
the man said, savouring the sound,
"how proud my dear wife would be to hear it. If only I hadn't killed her."
He sighed.
"And what of brave Lord Vargo?"
"Shall I sing you a verse of the reigns of Castamere? The goat won't be quite so brave when my father gets hold of him."
"And how will he do that? Are your father's arms so long they can reach over the walls of Harrenhal and pluck us out?"
"If need be. King Harren's monstrous folly had fallen before, and it could fall again. Are you such a fool as to think the goat can outfight the lion?"
Urswick leaned over and slapped him lazily across the face. The sheer casual insolence of it was worse than the blow itself.
"He does not fear me," Jamie realized with a chill.
"I've heard enough, Kingslayer. I would have to be a great fool indeed to believe the promises of an oath-breaker like you."
He kicked his horse and galloped smartly ahead.
"Ares," Jamie thought resentfully. "It always turns on Ares.
He swayed with the motion of his horse, wishing for a sword. Two swords would be even better, one for the wench and one for me. We'd die, but we'd take half of them down to hell with us.
"Why did you tell him Tarth was the Sapphire Isle?"
Brian whispered, when Urswick was out of earshot.
"He's like to think my father's rich in gemstones."
"You best pray he does."
"Is every word you say a lie, Kingslayers? Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle for the blue of its waters." "Shout it a little louder, wench. I don't think Urswick heard you." "The sooner they know how little you're worth in ransom, the sooner the rapes begin. Every man here will mount you. But what do you care? Just close your eyes, open your legs, and pretend they're all Lord Renly."
Mercifully, that shut her mouth for a time. The day was almost done by the time they found Vargo Hote, sacking a small sept with another dozen of his brave companions. The leaded windows had been smashed, the carved wooden guards dragged out into the sunlight. The fattest Dothraki Jamie had ever seen was sitting on the mother's chest when they rode up, prying out her chalcedony eyes with the point of his knife. Nearby, a skinny, balding septon hung upside down from the limb of a spreading chestnut tree. Three of the brave companions were using his corpse for an archery butt. One of them must have been good the dead man had arrows through both of his eyes. When the sellsword spied Urswick and the captives, a cry went up in half a dozen tongues. The goat was seated by a cook fire, eating a half-cooked bird off a skewer, grease and blood running down his fingers into his long, stringy beard. He wiped his hands on his tunic and rose.
"Kingslayer," he slubbered, "you are my captive."
"My lord, I am Brian of Tarth," the wench called out. "Lady Catelyn Stark commanded me to deliver Sir Jamie to his brother at King's Landing."
The goat gave her a disinterested glance.
"Silence, sir."
"Hear me,"
Brian entreated, as Rorg cut the ropes that bound her to Jamie.
"In the name of the King of the North, the king you serve, please listen."
Rorg dragged her off the horse and began to kick her.
"See that he don't break any bones,"
Urswick called out to him.
"The horse-faced bitch is worth a weight in sapphires."
The Dornish man, Timian, and a foul-smelling Ibanez pulled Jamie down from the saddle and shoved him roughly toward the cook fire. It would not have been hard for him to have grasped one of their sword hilts as they manhandled him, but there were too many, and he was still in fetters. He might cut down one or two, but in the end he would die for it. Jamie was not ready to die just yet, and certainly not for the likes of Brian of Tarth.
"This is a sweet day,"
Varga Hoat said. Around his neck hung a chain of linked coins, coins of every shape and size, cast and hammered, bearing the likenesses of kings, wizards, gods and demons, and all manner of fanciful beasts.
"Coins from every land where he has fought," Jamie remembered.
Greed was the key to this man.
"If he was turned once, he can be turned again.
Lord Vargo, you were foolish to leave my father's service, but it is not too late to make amends. He will pay well for me, you know it."
"Oh, yes," said Vargo Hote. "Half the gold in Casterly Rock I shall have, but first I must send him a message."
He said something in his slithery, goatish tongue. Urswick shoved him in the back, and a jester in green and pink motley kicked his legs out from under him. When he hit the ground, one of the archers grabbed the chain between Jamie's wrists and used it to yank his arms out in front of him. The fat Dothraki put aside his knife to unsheathe a huge curved arrack, the wickedly sharp scythe sword the horse lords loved.
"They mean to scare me."
The fool hopped on Jamie's back, giggling as the Dothraki swaggered toward him.
"The goat wants me to piss my breeches and beg his mercy. But he'll never have that pleasure."
He was a Lannister of Casterly Rock, Lord Commander of the King's Guard. No sellsword would make him scream.
Sunlight ran silver along the edge of the Arrak as it came shivering down almost too fast to see. And Jamie screamed.
John. His candle had guttered out in a pool of wax, but morning light was shining through the shutters of his window. John had fallen asleep over his work again. Books covered his table, tall stacks of them. He'd fetched them up himself, after spending half the night searching through dusty vaults by lantern light. Sam was right. The books desperately needed to be sorted, listed, and put in order, but that was no task for stewards who could neither read nor write. It would need to wait for Sam's return. If he does return. John feared for Sam and Maester Aemon. Cutter Pike had written from Eastwatch to report that the Stormcrow had sighted the wreckage of a galley along the coast of Skagos. Whether the broken ship was Blackbird, one of Stannis Baratheon's sail-sails, or some passing trader, the crew of the Stormcrow had not been able to discern. I meant to send Gilly and the babe to safety. Did I send them to their graves instead? Last night's supper had congealed beside his elbow, scarce touched. Dolorous Ed had filled his trencher almost overflowing to allow three-finger Hobb's infamous three-meat stew to soften the stale bread. The jest among the brothers was that the three meats were mutton, mutton, and mutton, but carrot, onion, and turnip would have been closer to the mark. A film of cold grease glistened atop the remains of the stew. Bowen Marsh had urged him to move into the old bear's former chambers in the King's Tower after Stannis vacated them. But John had declined. Moving into the King's chambers could too easily be taken to mean he did not expect the King to return. A strange listlessness had settled over Castle Black since Stannis had marched south, as if the Free Folk and the Black Brothers alike were holding their breath, waiting to see what would come. The yards and dining hall were empty more often than not. The Lord Commander's tower was a shell, the old common hall a pile of blackened timbers, and Harden's tower looked as if the next gust of wind would knock it over. The only sound of life that John could hear was the faint clash of swords coming from the yard outside the armory. Arn Emmett was shouting at Hop Robin to keep his shield up. We'd all best keep our shields up. John washed and dressed and left the armory, stopping in the yard outside just long enough to say a few words of encouragement to Hop Robin and Emmett's other charges. He declined Ty's offer of a tale, as usual. He would have men enough about him. If it came to blood, two more would hardly matter. He did take Longclaw, though, and Ghost followed at his heels. By the time he reached the stable, Dolorous Ed had the Lord Commander's palfrey saddled and bridled and waiting for him. The wains were forming up beneath Bowen Marsh's watchful eye. The Lord Steward was trotting down the column, pointing and fussing, his cheeks red from the cold. When he spied John, they reddened even more.
"Lord Commander, are you still intent on this folly?" finished John.
"Please tell me you are not about to say folly, my lord."
"Yes, I am.
We have been over this. East Watch wants more men. The Shadow Tower wants more men, Grey Guard and Icemark as well. I have no doubt. And we have 14 other castles still sitting empty. Long leagues of wall that remain unwatched and undefended." Marsh pursed his lips.
"Lord Commander Mormont is dead,
and not at wildling hands, but at the hands of his own sworn brothers, men he trusted. Neither you nor I can know what he would or would not have done in my place." John wheeled his horse around. "Enough talk. Away." Dolorous Ed had heard the entire exchange. As Bowen Marsh trotted off, he nodded towards his back and said,
"Pomegranates, all those seeds, a man could choke to death. I'd sooner have a turnip. Never knew a turnip to do a man any harm.
It was at times like this that John missed Maester Aemon the most. Clydus tended to the ravens well enough, but he had not a tenth of Aemon Targaryen's knowledge or experience, and even less of his